So let's give Dr. Garrett a big welcome.
It is very nice to be back, and good to see you all. And here we go. What does the word pagan do for you? Does it suggest a motorcycle gang, maybe? Some rowdy behavior in the 1960s in the Haight-Ashbury, a bunch of pagans. Historically, the word pagan was used as a word of disparagement by traditional monotheistic religions to describe alternative philosophies and religions. They were lumped together as paganos, country people, hillbillies, right? They were believed to have unsophisticated beliefs, country ways, and the older religion, that old-time religion. You'd find it, you can still find it if you travel in Greece. You'll go on back trails, particularly. You'll find a little temple that's all kind of tumbled down, but it's a temple to Dionysus, or one of the goddesses there. So those were the old pagan beliefs that were scripted as being both naive and tainted with a hint of savagery. And look out, they handle snakes, things like that. That was the idea. The so-called pagan view has a long history in the West. It goes from the earliest work of literature that's usually acknowledged in Western civilization, Homer's epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. It also goes forward to the pre-Socratic philosophers like Heraclitus, and to the Greco-Roman Stoics. I see out there in the lobby, there's a Stoic prayer up there, so that's the idea. The list also includes the American philosopher and one-time Unitarian, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I'll be talking about Emerson in more detail later on today. The central point is that nature is sacred. Nature is the ultimate reality. A big difference between in the pagan view from the traditional monotheistic view is that nature is not seen as a secondary derivative reality. First there was God, and God said, let there be light, and then almost as a secondary derivative reality, there is nature. Human beings were scripted as being in nature, but not of nature. We know that we're not of nature because the rest of the animal kingdom heaves beastie breath, right? Whereas where does our breath come from? God. We have God breathed our breath into us. So our breath is sacred. Pagan thinkers tend to take nature as being the ultimate reality. How do they engage death? I'll just give a very brief, not as a way station. They don't see this life as a way station in the ascent to another world, a higher world, a heaven. I have a destiny that goes beyond this world. It's expressed kind of in the country and Western lyrics. If you believe in forever, in life is just a one night stand. So that's the idea. Pagan views of death are eloquently expressed in a Chinese pagan philosophy, Taoism, that with the yin yang, the Tao of nature is the ultimate reality. And in the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu says, when your body dies, you don't cease to exist. You exist everywhere, right? Think of it in terms of being recycled, kind of. Your true identity right now is that you are part of nature. After you die, you're still part of nature, but just in a different form. Paganism not only has a history, it has a future. The tensions between science and religion are well known. Is it going to be evolution or creationism? Is it God or science? And the assumption shared, unfortunately, by both sides of this oftentimes rancorous dispute is that a choice is necessary. Either or, pick one, reject the other. I'm going to be suggesting that you can mix and match monotheism with paganism, especially in a 21st century paganism that doesn't exist on a kind of rectitude. I mentioned Spinoza, very interesting guy, 17th century, and got himself in big trouble. What is the ultimate reality? He wrote in Latin all the time because he was afraid of what would happen. It actually happened. He called it Deus sive natura, God or nature. Oh, God, nature. Nature is God. Nature and God are one and the same thing. This was really frowned upon, and sure enough, he was nearly assassinated for doing that stuff. So he didn't publish his major work until he left instructions, publish it after I die because I don't want anybody helping me across in a very real way. So neo-pagan, today neo-paganism is something of a recovery project, a recovery of the sense of nature's sacredness. We're already a long way there, do you agree? I think that there's a great deal of, you can call it the Gaia hypothesis, you can call it just the idea of the general oneness and sacredness that we have about nature. Take it in what I'll be talking about next week. The Anthropocene, where we see that you can't just treat nature like an extraction industry process. You have to live with nature. You have to live in a sense of balance with nature. So it's going to, we're seeing right now a re-embrace of a natural, of an awareness of our natural context and reality and of the potentials for human beings in that context. My assumption is that for all the contentions between science and religion, humans are possessed. We are just naturally. We're not talking about believing in God now. We are naturally possessed of a sense of the sacred. That just comes natural to every child born. There is a natural disposition to religion. Careful, by religion, I mean nothing other than a sense of the sacred. I'm not saying that everybody naturally believes in God, although there are good arguments for that. I'm not one myself, but there are good arguments for it. We tend to conceive the divine in terms of what we are. So, okay, not an irrational argument. Having an acute sense of the sacred is bound up with the unique form of consciousness that modern humans have. I don't want to get technical on you here, but we are not Homo sapiens. Did you know that? We are, in fact, Homo sapiens sapiens. Homo sapiens, they're sometimes called archaic Homo sapiens, they're gone. Actually, they didn't disappear. They became us to a certain extent. And I'll be saying more about this next week when we talk about the Anthropocene. But basically, they were driven to extinction by a natural disaster, by a supervolcano called Mount Toba about 74,000 years ago. About 10,000 years after that, somewhere about 65,000 years ago, we emerged, and the task was we emerged as a very small group. We would have been on an endangered species list. We had to cooperate. To cooperate, we had to be able to learn to read each other's thoughts. I can tell what I can see on your face what you're thinking about the ideas I'm presenting about where we should go and where we shouldn't go. No, there's going to be a fight coming from there, but this guy over here agrees with me, right? So it's called intentional consciousness, to promote that cooperation. Cooperation is our species' middle name, as it were. I mean, it is just natural to us to do this. That is how we survived from the time we arrived as Homo sapiens sapiens. Our consciousness is not merely a nexus of calculation. It is also powerfully conditioned by emotion. The capacity for openness, literally open-mindedness in the face of the unknowable, is the basis of the rationality that came to define us as a species and that continues with us today. It's the very heart of the scientific method. I'll have more to say about that in just a few minutes. That same capacity, realized in terms of emotion, finds expression in what we today call wonder. Wonder co-evolved with our uniquely reflexive consciousness. We are not only conscious, I not only know what I know there's a glass of water sitting there, but I know that I know it, right? So I not only have feelings about my feelings. I have intentions about my intentions. Our consciousness curves back on itself. Wonder co-evolved again with that kind of reflexive consciousness. Wonder, like calculation, is at the evolutionary heart of what it is to be human. And that's an important point. Our evolution is not merely history, not just a tale about the past, but emphatically a presence operative within us right now. We can say then that human beings are born to wonder. To state it more carefully, we humans can live without wonder, but we can't thrive without wonder. There are people who manage to live without wonder. The light has kind of evacuated in their eyes, and there's no wonder left. Animals, love them though we do not, cannot wonder. Try it. Try it for yourself on a glorious starry night. Take your sweet pet, your kitty cat that's your buddy, and your puppy that's your buddy, and take them out. And breathtaking sky, but your beloved pet looks at you and says, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." Right? I mean, tells you that with their eyes. Take its head, gently turn it up to the sky. If you persist in doing this, you're just going to creep out your little pet, right? They're going to, "I'll come back when you're feeling better," okay? Animals don't wonder. Here, that's not a very controversial statement. Here is a more controversial statement. If we are to take the stories that we hear about God at face value, God can't wonder either. God is omniscient. No room for wonder in omniscience, in a very, very, very literal sense. He's omniscient. If God, according to tradition, is omniscient, then he is not omnipotent. Can I talk this way? Omniscient means all-knowing. Omnipotent can do anything. Actually, if he is omniscient, the one thing that God cannot do is wonder. We can, he can't. Sorry, no earthquakes or anything like that, so I'll proceed. Does that make sense? Precisely because God is omniscient, he is incapable of wonderment. We have something that God doesn't have. This sounds like an unlucky way to talk, especially in church, but it's an interesting way to think. It is our uniquely human capacity to wonder that opens us to the sacredness of nature. But without some illustrations, claims like these are blurry and vague. We are in a Unitarian church, and I've already mentioned Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was a one-time. He left the Unitarian church because for a lot of reasons that I won't go into right now. But nobody says it better than Emerson in his famous essay on nature. He says this, and I'm quoting now. "To go into solitude, a man needs to retire as much from his chamber, his study, as from society. I am not solitary while I read and write, though nobody is with me. But if a man would be alone, let him look at the stars." If you want to commune with nature, you got to go by yourself. And that doesn't mean you bring a book with you, right? You got to get out of your study. You got to get out of society and go look at the stars. He continues, "The stars awaken a certain reverence because though they are always present, they are inaccessible. But all natural objects make a kind of kindred impression when the mind is open to their influence." And then he starts to sing, "Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed in the cool air and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see everything. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part and particle of God. He uses the word God rather in the same way that Spinoza uses the word God. When he speaks of nature, he's speaking of God. Emerson, and that's an important thing. Spinoza shocked his culture. I've already mentioned that. He shocked his culture and precipitated an assassination attempt by speaking of God or nature. This is that nature and God are one and the same thing. No, God is the creator. Nature is the creation, right? And don't ever forget that. Emerson was on safer ground in New England. But in his essay, he says something else, and this fascinates me. Something that did give his contemporaries pause to think. He's speaking of that direct communication with nature, and he says, "To speak truly, few adult persons can see nature. Most persons do not see the sun. At least they have a very superficial seeing. The sun illuminates only the eye of the man, but shines into the eye and the heart of the child. The lover of nature is he in whom inward and outward senses are still truly adjusted to each other, who has restrained the spirit of infancy, who has retained the spirit of infancy even into manhood." So to see it, you have to, lots of people have spoken this way, the wonder of a child. Wordsworth used to speak of children being natural nature mystics. What Emerson says here, I think, is important, and it brings us back to what even God can't do, and that is wonder. Do you agree with that? If it's really true that he knows everything, right? The more you know, the less you wonder. And one of the things that we do to kids, we say, "Oh, it's very good. You've learned geography. You've learned this." And they take a natural pride in what they know. And at a certain time, they think, "You know, I know that." Emerson disparages getting old, but he's not talking about age and years. He's talking about, "You know, I used to think that too. You know, it's just, I'm familiar with all that. It's no big deal, right? A sunset is just light refracted through dust. Don't get dust particles. Don't get all agitated about it." Look at the night sky. We all are. And they're exploring the Milky Way with flashlights. It's an exquisite metaphor for the human predicament in science. We will never know everything. Science is changing so fast that I sometimes will say, "Listen, man, have I been around this game? I remember when the cosmos was 20 billion years old, huh? That's how long I've been reading this stuff, right?" That is to say, the approximate age, the consensus age of the cosmos used to be 20 billion years old. Before that, it used to be something like 400,000 years old. Now it is 13.82 billion years old. The age of the Earth, that's an easy one. It's fun. 4.567 billion years old. He said, "Pardon?"
And counting.
Counting in two different ways. I mean, time is passing, and somebody will discover wait a minute, we've got to readjust our calculations as to how old the Earth is or how old the cosmos is. This idea that science is, you never get a handle on it. Whatever you know is what you know for this season, this month maybe, this week maybe. I'm very fond of a headline of an article in the science page of the Manchester Guardian that said, "Everything you know about evolution is wrong." Great. And it is. If you studied evolution, say, when you were in college or 20, 30 years ago, or even 15 years ago, the field has evolved. It's been refined. We have different understandings of what our ancestors are. So it's kind of exciting. So you look at the night sky. If you know how to look, you will see the Milky Way. It's not a big trick. You can see the Milky Way up there, especially if you go out into the country, out into like Utah or something like that, where the light pollution isn't so bad. You will see the Milky Way galaxy of which we are a part. You will never, but never understand this. And you know in your heart that you will never understand this, yet knowing that you won't understand it doesn't dampen your valuation of the moment, not in the least. In fact, it inflames it. This is literally beyond my power to comprehend, and I'll spend the rest of my life working at that, but I'll never succeed. And ain't it glorious? I mean, that's the idea. We're in the position of those three people on the illustration that I couldn't resist bringing with me, using flashlights to somehow get a grasp of the Milky Way. An awareness of the incompleteness and the tentativeness of everything that we know. If you lose that awareness, if you think, I've got that now, well, you already know how evolution works, and you don't need to hear anything new, right? I mean, I've got the, you know, I studied that when I was your age, and I've got it down. That kills wonder. To a certain extent, that awareness of the incompleteness and the tentative nature of whatever science knows right now, just hang on, it will change. Physics has changed so much since Einstein's day, and he knew that would happen. If Einstein were to show up at a physics conference somewhere, and everybody would all, oh, Professor Einstein, you're so great, we still believe everything that you said. You say, what the hell? Is nobody doing physics anymore? What do you mean? You still accept all my theories? It's been a long time now, and I trust things have moved on a bit. So another way of putting it, again, as a group of Unitarians, we have one of our homeboys as a poet who says things like nobody else does. I'm a big fan, obviously, of Emerson. And so in another essay, less famous than Nature, on Nature, this essay is titled Circles. Anybody ever read it? It's just a knockout. Yeah, it's just terrific. Here's what he says. All space, the moon and stars, the clouds and sky, the sun itself, and what is beyond are all objects of our interest. We cannot know them, but we can love them. But to love them, we must always be alive to what is not yet known of them. We can never know of them. When you know how to know nothing, then you may hear the whisper. When you are free to know nothing, then you can hear the whisper of something true. And so become possessed yet again, as when you were a child, by wonder. This is an important thing. In this essay, he speaks, he becomes scolding. Shame on you if you get old. What the hell? You don't want to say that, you know. Look at us here. We're all getting old. For Emerson, is not a matter of counting years. Getting old is a matter of disposition. I have known people in their 20s who are old. Have you? I mean, it's just no big deal. Nothing's a big deal. Freud once remarked on the depressing contrast between the radiant intelligence of the average child and the defeated torpor of the average adult. Before? After? What the hell happened? I mean, Jesus was clearly onto something when he repeatedly claimed that the kingdom of heaven is uniquely accessible to children. The mark of wonder is openness. Children are remarkably open to experience. They haven't yet been, as it were, shut down by all the right answers, by all the correct answers. This is what. Well, how do we know that God doesn't have a body? Well, we just know it. These are the answers that we live by. An uncharitable suspicion is this: there is something volitional in our loss of wonder. It hasn't been taken away from us. It hasn't been beaten out of us. It hasn't been socialized about out of us, not even by all the right answers. It's something that we let happen. It's something that we do. It's something that hasn't been. Your parents love you so much that they just want you to have the right answers, right? So sometimes wonder is loved out of kids. It's something that we do better. It's something that we capitulate to. We let wonder go. We agree with ourselves to set it aside, to no longer go there. In settling for what we already know, we reject the childlike capacity to be excited by what we don't know. And thus, we voluntarily become old, to say the word again. Emerson's essay Circles invokes the sense of what I'm speaking of here. And I'm quoting him again. He says, "We grizzle every day. I see no need for it. We engage in what is beyond us. We don't grow old if we do, but we grow young. The one thing we seek above all is to be surprised out of our propriety, out of our habits, and to do something without knowing how or why, that is, to draw a new circle beyond ourselves. Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. The simplest words, the simplest acts, we don't know what they mean except when we love and aspire." There they go. This wonderment, this aspiration is, I suggest, the essence of the religious disposition, and everybody is born with one. Some of us lose it, and you can always get it back, but you have to be willing to say, you know what, I don't know, and live comfortably with that skeptical attitude. The wonderment, the aspiration, is the essence of religion, but I'm starting to sound sappy here, so I want to sober up a bit, take a clear moment, and apologize. Not to you, but to Richard Dawkins. Sorry, Dick, but in the terms just set forth, you are a religious man. It is glaringly and wonderfully evident throughout your writings, even at your angriest. I too get angry about stuff sometimes, right? But j'accuse Richard Dawkins as being a religious man. He is. I mean, that's the paradigm case of it, of a scientist slowly creeping up on it, was Carl Sagan, who was not just an atheist, but said the whole religion thing is just, you know, it's time for us to move on. And then he did his show, Cosmos, and he got to showing people how to look at the cosmos, and gradually, over time, he became possessed of how sacred this topic was that he was talking about. And I went to a talk by Dawkins over in San Francisco, as you know, Sagan is dead, and he was saying this whole idea, he was doing his usual shtick about the God delusion, and that religion itself, not just a belief in God, but religion itself is, and somebody in the audience said, "But what about Carl Sagan?" He says, "Everybody always asks me that." He says, "Okay, I allow that there is something to," he called it, "Sagonian sacredness." It's kind of like, all right, okay, fine. You can understand why Sagan is angry, because it is difficult to watch small children being educated to the idea that they are born in sin, that there is no such thing as evolution, that the universe is 6,000 years old, and your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa used to ride around on dinosaurs. Well, why am I speaking with a southern accent when I say this? Because most of this happens in the South. There is the Museum of Creation History, where they have little things of dinosaurs with saddles on them that you can put your kids on. Okay. So, there is something risky in educating children, in waking up and encouraging that sense of wonder. Because another way to characterize that wonder is to see it as an invincible curiosity. Wonder drives us to dissatisfaction, dissatisfaction with any and all answers. We tend to pick at things. We say, okay, just pick it. This emphatically includes our answers in science and philosophy and religion. It drives us relentlessly beyond what we already know. What we already know is somehow unsatisfying because we already know it, and there's kind of no mystery there anymore. It is a profoundly destabilizing element in the human psyche. It is an innate disposition to, as I say, pick. Well, if that's the case, then what about this? And you just find exceptions to it. And finally, we get tired of kids, and because that's just how it is, because I said so, I'm tired of talking. Let's just stop this now, right? Because the kid is never going to tire of why. Put otherwise, it is entirely natural and human for us to outgrow all and every capital U understanding of reality that we encounter. We will never be able to settle. There is something unstable and restless. We'll never be able to settle for the capital T truth. Truth is beyond our capacity it's beyond the human capacity. This was exquisitely presented and stated in a guy who didn't write like Emerson. He wrote, the problem wasn't that he wrote in German, but he wrote in analytic style, and it's turgid, but it's worth the study. Kant's Critique of Pure Reason in 1781 simply says, we will never know reality. We'll never know what those stars are out there. And then somebody put the question to him, well, what about God? You know that God says, absolutely not. I reject reason and its truth to make way for faith. He says, I will never know whether God exists. It's beyond a human capacity to know that. But I choose to live as if God exists. That's how he put it. That idea of a provisional metaphor that you hold up in place of a truth. The beauty of a metaphor is that it can transform itself. It can change. That's the wonderful power of it. There's a reason why the young teacher of some 2,000 years ago, and we know he was young because he was murdered at age 33, right? Which starts to sound younger and younger and younger as you get along, right? His favorite teaching, his preferred teaching vehicle was a species of metaphor, the parable. There is no right answer to a parable. A parable is first cousin to a Zen koan, right? What's the true meaning of that? Well, it changes. What's the true meaning of literature? It changes with your understanding of it. What does Hamlet or Macbeth really mean? Well, it meant one thing to you when you were 15, maybe you first read it. It meant something else when you're 25, then 35, then 65, and 75. It means different things at different times. It literally depends. The meaning depends on the mind that's approaching it. It's a very powerful way of teaching. And as I say, it was Jesus' favorite. So we naturally outgrow any and all understandings. We naturally pick at the truth. It's natural, but it's not easy, because every child born into wonder gets pressured to grow up and be sensible. This is just what Emerson warns against, and in so doing makes himself a guy that parents worry about sometimes. You know, yes, of course, I want you to think for yourself, but I want you to come up with the right answers too. You know, that kind of attitude. I want you to be sensible about things. And of course, teachers go through the same thing. And alas, children are taught and encouraged to take pride in what they know. You've done it. You understand how Newton's law of universal gravitation works. You understand his laws of motion. You understand what Darwin meant by evolution by means of natural selection. And we do that to ourselves. Good, I've got it. And when somebody comes along with a different revision, it triggers what's called the Pluto effect. The Pluto effect is what happened to people when they heard that Pluto, sorry, isn't a planet after all. It's the one that we all learned, and it's the little tail out there, and it was sort of Mickey Mouse's Pluto, and we all liked it. Oh, the state of New Mexico, where the observatory was, their House of Representatives had held what they called a Planet Pluto Day, where they passed a resolution that Pluto is a planet. Bless them, and you can understand why they do that, but that's the impulse. I already know this. You see it among brilliant scientists. E.O. Wilson, an evolutionary scientist, came up with the idea that natural selection doesn't just turn on the individual, it turns on kin selection and also group selection. And for a long time, group selection was a heresy. And Dawkins, bless his pointed head, I've learned a lot from Richard Dawkins, from reading Richard Dawkins, but he says, oh, obviously Wilson is becoming, he is in his mid-80s now, poor fellow, he's lost his mind, because he said something I disagree with. That's the idea of the kind of the closed mind. Dawkins, unfortunately, has lost his capacity to wonder. At least it's easy to lose your capacity to wonder in a field in which you are a recognized expert. I think that's the trick. So again, Emerson accepts all this and holds the possibility that you don't, your body is going to age. Look at me. I used to be this other guy, right? But I don't have to get old. That's the thing. And you get old if you, it's kind of building certainties around yourself. The circle that you build around yourself becomes a brick wall. And then you start saying to young people or people who think differently, you know, we're in church, but I'll say it anyway. That's just bullshit, right? I'm much too sensible to go for that sort of thing. So again, he insists that we are complicit in this hype, and his essays carry a barb. Shame on you for getting old, because being old in an Emersonian sense is not measured in ideas, but in a foppish pride in what we know, what we already know. Let us say, for safety's sake, that God is not a fop, because he really does know everything. I mean, when I'm taking the accounts at face value. He's not a fop because of his omniscience. That is his reality. But you are a fop, no matter how, if you're still in your 20s or 30s, if you allow yourself to preen too much over what you know and what you, there's a Zen metaphor. You can't put any more tea in a cup that's already filled. So our education can become our enemy in a certain way. When you are complacent in the certainty of what you know, you pretend to a godlike state that for a human being is a thoroughly unholy state. Your complacency, your complacent certainty renders you incapable of doubt, which is to say, incapable of wonder. And you have immunized yourself against experiencing the sense of sacredness that Emerson and so many others found in nature. If you think that this is the purview of wispy poets and mystics, consider this. There is a hard-boiled, just young guy, Israeli. He's a historian. He's a philosopher of science. He is great. His name is Yuval Harari, H-A-R-A-R-I. Anybody read him? It's just incredible work. And a recent book that he wrote, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, makes the claim that the most important discovery that science has ever made since science is being practiced is the discovery of ignorance, right? That's what science is about. It's discovering, we were ignorant on that particular point. And I'm quoting him now. He says, modern science is based on a Latin injunction, ignoramus, That sounds like an insult, right? It's a no, it's a declaration. It's sort of the motto of society. In Latin, it's a one-word complete sentence. We don't know. That's what it means. We don't know. So ignoramus, we don't know. The assumption is not only that we don't know everything, even more critically, the assumption is that the things that we think we know can be proven wrong as we gain more knowledge. No concept, no idea, no theory is sacred and beyond challenge. A cursory reading of the history of science shows that, especially scientific revolutions, these revolutions were significantly impeded by expert opinion. Hey, look, I've been doing this for 40 years, right? And I'm telling what you're doing. I used to think that way when I was younger, right? So I kind of know what you're, but you're wrong. It's impeded by what we know. And this dynamic continues right down to 2017. It's downright unpagan, in that good sense of being able to relate to nature. If you followed any one field in science, you know it's not that anybody has rejected evolutionary theory, but they've refined and refined and refined it. Darwin knew nothing about DNA. We used to know a lot about DNA, and we used to think that DNA was a code that pretty much determined your potentials. You know, you got lucky in the DNA draw, or you didn't get lucky in DNA. Now that's all changed. We know that the DNA is sheathed in a protective sheath called histone, the epigenome, right? That not only protects it, but controls it. We know that now that if you study when you were a kid, you really do make yourself smarter because the various different other genes get turned on and you can improve your intelligence. It sounds really weird here, but this is transgenerational. You'll not only make yourself smarter, you'll make your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren smarter. So again, in that the Guardian, the title of the Guardian Science article I told you, Everything You Know About Evolution Is Wrong. Pretty accurate. And a good thing to remember. Okay. What is our time limit? Is it a good time for question Q&A?
We can go on until 10:30.
I'm sorry. Okay, that's good for Q&A. Yeah.
And then at 10:30 you can do the Q&A.
Oh, okay.
You have lots of time.
Okay. I'm usually, but let me just get a couple of questions here.
You seem to have overlooked the two aspects of paganism that are the most important to me.
Sir.
And those aspects are reincarnation and polytheism.
I could not understand what you're saying because it all came as kind of a blur.
There are two aspects of paganism that are very important to me personally. They are reincarnation and polytheism, and you seem not to have mentioned either one.
I'll go over here. Very good point. I didn't mention reincarnation for a variety of reasons. One of them is that, again, I haven't got any, but I've studied this for 25 years, and it's nonsense. I find that reincarnation is a pernicious idea. Reincarnation is not a standalone idea. Reincarnation comes attended by the notion of karma. Karma is a law of consequence. That's great. But what happens with karma and reincarnation and you know, a lot of people that I greatly respect buy into this. Many 21st century Buddhists, the first thing that they say, we are 21st century Western Buddhists, and the first thing that we've done is reject reincarnation theory. Why? Because when people believe that your present state is the result of previous actions that you've done, and some kid is born with Down syndrome, well, I wonder what they did. Or you get cancer at a young age. What did you do to bring that on? Even worse in terms of social classes, If you believe in reincarnation theory and karma, and by the way, you don't have to be Indian to do that. It's right in Plato's Republic is a fully worked out theory of reincarnation, that you get born according to what the habits you develop in previous lives. What that means is that people who are downtrodden and poor and impoverished, this is not unjust. This is deep justice. They're working out their karma. That's why I've been persuaded by people who know more than I do that karma is kind of a polytheism. By contrast, is glorious. I love it. It's too bad many people have lamented. The philosopher that I really like is Friedrich Nietzsche. He says there's nothing wrong with believing in God, but just one. If we're going to have a theism, you've got to have something where there is Artemis, the goddess of austerity and chastity, and Aphrodite, the goddess of sexual pleasure and indulgence, right? So, because at different stages in one life, one will be a devotee of Aphrodite and then sort of slipping over to a little bit maybe to Artemis, or the god Dionysus or Apollo. Those are two that Nietzsche spoke a great deal about. The god of Apollo wants order, wants rationality. Dionysus is much more, the image of Mick Jagger comes to mind. Not fair, but his performance persona. I don't know if that was a very satisfactory idea, but that sense of both reincarnation and polytheism are completely compatible with a neo-pagan outlook. That is to say, within nature, there are all these different gods. Within nature, there is constant, it's not really reincarnation, it's kind of recycling. Actually, the German philosopher, one of the first people to take Indian philosophy seriously, Arthur Schopenhauer, deeply pessimistic guy, but he rejected the idea of reincarnation for a theory of recycling. You just get recycled back and forth. And it's not an alien idea, actually, for many people who are terrified of death. I'm thinking now of a Zen master, Manzan, who was in the 18th century. One of the students came to him, "But then what happens to us when we die, sir?" And he looked at them and he said, "What did your face look like before your grandparents were born? How bad was that?" In other words, what awaits you after your death is what awaited you before you, what you were before your birth. You are nature. And here you are, nature expressed as Jack or Jill, right? And you thrive as Jack or Jill, and then you sort of are reabsorbed into nature, and things get reconstituted. That's basically the theory of physics. Lawrence Krauss, one of the astrophysicists, he's funny when he talks about it, because he says, literally, you are a star child. Every atom in your body came from the inside of a star. And he said, probably the atoms in my right hand came from a different galaxy than the atoms of my left hand. So literally, we are recycled that way. What gets lost is personal immortality. And personal immortality is attractive for many people. And many pagan religions did hold that, like there's Valhalla, which actually has its comedic aspects of it in the Nordic religion, that the Scandinavian and German, they would believe in Valhalla. And they would say, I'll tell you what, lend me $100 and I'm going to give you back $500 in Valhalla. Okay. All right. You'll sign a contract. Yeah, I'll sign a contract. Obviously we got a con game going here, but so they did have the idea of a happy hunting ground or some such thing. More realistic perhaps was the Homeric view of what happens at Earth, and purely pagan view. Nature tells the whole story. When you die, it is a diminution. It is a subtraction. You don't go to hell. People misunderstand what the word Hades means. Hades is not hell. It's not a place of punishment. It's what happens when you dissociate the psyche from the body. The psyche goes into a place that looks suspiciously like an Alzheimer's colony, right? Literally, people don't remember anything. I'm talking about book 12 of the Odyssey now, when Odysseus goes down to Hades. And in order to be hold discourse with people, he has to take sheep down with him, cut their throats, and give them some blood to drink. Ah, Odysseus, what are you doing here? You know, all of a sudden, now they can start talking. So that idea of an afterlife finds its place into some pagan religions. Most of them are more, and especially most of the modern 21st century religious views that are informed by science, right? Informed by neuroscience. Now, I see I had another question come in, so please go ahead.
It seems like...
I'm sorry? Oh, whoa. Okay. I'm going to have a drink.
Even though these beliefs have... what you would call bad results, they might still be true.
I don't think anybody else can understand it either. Even if the reincarnation and polytheism have what you would call bad moral consequences, they might still be true.
Yeah.
And I do, from personal experience, believe that one can remember past incarnations.
Yes. Yes.
I can remember them.
Yes. And I'm not going to doubt that for a second. Polytheism has no untoward moral consequences that I can see of. Basically, it's just my lefty concern about social justice that makes me worry about seeing people as working out their karma, right? Or they're being exploited, they're being, you know, people in desperate circumstances and Bangladesh, for example. Well, you know, part of our human responsibility is to help them out.
I think we need you at the microphone.
Yes.
Sorry.
To help them out, and somebody will say, no, they're taking care of some, they're doing some very important work there. Same people will be foursquare against euthanasia, right, where somebody is dying and it can't be cured of some particularly disease that's robbing them of their life and their dignity. You know, and they would want this ended. They no longer have the capacity to express their will. And somebody would say, no, they're doing very important work right now. Don't, with your meddling good intentions, go in. And this is something that we could talk about till the cows come home. But what I want to say is that both reincarnation and belief in an afterlife, and of course polytheism, Homer is the great example of that. That there's lots of polytheism. Well, there's one for every disposition. Practically, there's a god for every disposition. So let me ask if there's any. Yes, please.
To me, one of the more attractive parts about neo-paganism is it seems to be able to hold both monotheism and polytheism, as well as dualism and the opposite. And to me, it's like Hinduism. You can call it polytheistic, but there's an Atman idea.
Yes.
That abstracts things. And so when you talk about God being omniscient and so forth, you're talking about an anthropomorphic God.
Yeah.
If you're talking about the Great Spirit, it can... it's an umbrella for so many different
Excellent
beliefs.
Point.
It's more eclectic.
Yes, and I couldn't agree with you more. Whatever, you know, survey whatever your religious beliefs are, you can find that in Hinduism, right? You can, if you're a monotheist. The one point I would disagree in, monotheism, traditional monotheism, now not where monotheism where God becomes nature or something like that, which some people actually believe that God is one with nature. Meister Eckhart, a 14th century mystic, had those beliefs and barely escaped the Inquisition. He was summoned to Rome for an examination by the Inquisition. And I liked my version of this, my favorite version of it. He says, I know where this story goes from here. I'm going to hell, back to the Rhine River, making some wine. I'll talk to people, but I just tell them I died on the way, right? That's the story, is that he died on the way. I hope that he just figured out this is not good. What happened in traditional monotheism, and there's a reason for that. I'm not anti-Christian or anything like that. There are forms of Christianity now that are pagan, but they are seen as heretic versions. If you want to read a good pagan version of Christianity, a theologian named Sally McFaig, and she writes, some of her titles are Models of God. One that I particularly like is Super-Natural Christians. That is to say, they are supernatural. They see literally that nature is God's body, and this is splendid. And she changes the whole idea. And again, there's a reason for all this, and it's beyond the possibility for me to talk about now. But you're saved, and
I'm sorry, you didn't make the cut.
You know, you're saved. There's this God bloody lottery where you know if you don't believe this, you're gone. Are you Jewish? Sorry about that. This is dreadful stuff. McFaig says, we are either all saved or nobody is saved. Every human being is saved or none of them are saved. So this idea of she would bridle, I have a feeling, at being called a pagan, maybe a neo-pagan. She's a sophisticated... Pardon? Actually, yeah. As long as everybody here is comfortable with Stoicism, you got a Stoic prayer out there in the lobby. And dear Ralph Waldo Emerson, Emerson was more influential than people realized. Just a word about that. That guy that I told you about in very difficult taught classes in Kant, it is work because he uses technical language, but it was a revolution that changed the world, and he called it the transcendental philosophy. Transcendental is to say what we experience as nature is configured by the processes of knowing that pertain to the body of our species. It was called transcendental philosophy. It caught fire in transatlantic. It went to New England, caught fire where it came to be called transcendentalism. Right. So the movement with William James and James' father and Thoreau. They were reading Kant's philosophy and seeing that whole idea, rejecting the idea that it's possible to get truth from this. Then the ball went back to Europe, and Emerson's essays were bought by a German teenager and copiously read, annotated. The kid's name was Friedrich Nietzsche. He was deeply, profoundly influenced by Emerson. And that was a big part of the Nietzschean revolution. Where did he get his claim that God is dead? From Emerson's Divinity School address, where he said, you would think that God is dead the way everybody's talking. Well, I just get answers from somebody else. So a lot of Nietzsche's ideas came from, okay, it's like a tennis match. Ball goes back to New England, and Nietzsche's claim was the problem with believing in eternal damnation or something like that, or sin, is the effect that it has on your, what does that do for your life? Does that enhance your life or does it sort of diminish your life? The value of an idea, said Nietzsche, is the practice that it encourages, is what it does in somebody's life. This was taken by William James and C.S. Peirce, and it's called, well, they made the first genuinely American philosophy called pragmatism, right? Pragmatism. So it's just a lot of transatlantic tennis, as it were, with ideas. So I'm not sure if I'm still talking about your question, but yes. Where are you? Yes, thank you.
I was wondering what your ideas, thoughts are on worship in 21st century.
In the 21st century, those passages that I read to you from Emerson. That was worship when he went out and stood in a clearing in the forest and looked up at the sky, and that is as far as I can tell. And I'm not disparaging ritualized forms of worship. It can be very elegant. It can be very nice. Actually, it can be sublime. But worship need not be done in a church. Worship, in fact, for people like Emerson, you know, flee the church and get out and look at the sky, get out and just contemplate the ocean by yourself. It was a solitary experience for Emerson, kind of interesting. Other people have said it's much stronger if you have that worship in concert with other people. I've participated actually in groups of, it was a Hindu temple over there in San Francisco, the Vedanta Society, serious people. And they would have group meditations, which they said is very different. You meditate alone, good stuff, but very different to go into a large room where everybody is meditating. And I agree. I really agree. So worship, forms of worship are varied. I hate the idea that I was raised Catholic and I didn't get hurt, right? I'm not a recovering Catholic. But I always felt this thing that if you don't go to Mass every Sunday, you go straight to hell, boy, unless you can get yourself into a confessional and get absolution for it. You know, this is not worship, this is coercion. Right, so too much worship gets scripted. It is de facto coercion. But like-minded people getting together and celebrating the fact that they see the world in a similar way, never an identical way, but in a similar way, can be a sublime experience. But you can also worship after the fashion of Emerson, which I confess is my preferred mode of worship, has been since I've been 4 years old. That's it. I didn't even realize what was going on. My daddy explained to me that how did all those stars get there? He said, well, actually, they're so small. They're suns, and they look small because they're far away, and almost all of them have planets around, and there could be other Earths. And well, transformation of the night sky. And as a kid, right, but as I got to where I started reading, I couldn't read enough science fiction, right? I just was haunted by the idea that there's all that out there. And again, that's how I'd respond to that question. There are people who are sniffy about worship. I'm not. Who are strict Emersonians, who say if you want to genuinely worship, get the hell out of the church, right, and go off by yourself. I don't agree with that. I think that that different people are truly different, group worship can be sublime. Group worship, by the way, is not just sitting and meditating. Group worship can take the form of dance and singing together. Stephen Jay Gould, again, another barking atheist who sneered at her, he would just rhapsodize because he belonged to a choir, and they would sing, and his favorite piece of music was Bach's B minor Mass. And he said, it was just transcendent. It was just like I felt like I was part of the universe. Hate to offend you, Steve, but you got religion, buddy. In that crucial sense, that's what he found. That was his primary mode of worship, was being part of a choir. And I've never done that, but I'm sure I like the music that does that. And if I could somehow be part of that, oh my, I'd jump at it. I'm happy feet when it comes to singing. I hope that reference meant something to you.
Yes, I'd like to go back to your comments on Kant to Emerson to Nietzsche. And you wrap that up with a statement about what we make of these philosophies and how they enhance our lives. And the point I'd like to go here is Hitler and the Nazis drew heavily on Nietzsche. They misinterpret it into something horrific and anti-life.
Yes.
You know, the triumph of the will. That was very Nietzschean.
Yes.
Now, are we going to reject Nietzsche? And then back to Thornton Kant, because there's a further point I'm going with this, which is, as somebody who tends to think that karma and reincarnation are for real, my take on this understanding that when you see somebody who is suffering, and for those of us who care about social justice, mm-hmm. to take the doctrine of karma to say, oh, they must deserve it, they're doing important work, let them alone in their suffering, is an abhorrent misunderstanding of the concept of karma rather than the essence of the understanding of karma.
You're getting,
and I'm just tossing
right
that
there, yeah.
I'm just throwing this out for fun.
Good. It's fun. And it was truly a misunderstanding that was facilitated by Elizabeth. Who the hell's Elizabeth? Elizabeth Nietzsche, Fritz's sister, who became an ardent Nazi. And she said to Hitler, "You are the guy that my brother..." And Nietzsche described himself, he was horrified by this, by any kind of collectivist thinking. He said, "I am an anti-Semite." But you're bringing up something that's important. The fact that it's religion, right? Yes, religion is wonderful. Maybe. You will never understand natural socialism if you don't understand that before it was a political theory, because it was a religion. First and foremost, it was a religion predicated on race, on the Aryan race. It was called the Aryan race. It used to be called the Teutonic race. Helena Blavatsky, the theosophist, went to India and was set afire there, and she came back to Europe and started to... She was the one who brought the... It's a Sanskrit word, swastika, right? And so in India, you find all swastikas. You find swastikas everywhere. And you used to find them everywhere in America, too. I teach classes in Nazism, so I like to bring this stuff out. And there's these sweet, very sentimental cards. Good luck, happy days, and with a big swastika on it. You know, just very sweet. But it's dated from like 1910. There's the Swastika Coal Company from... There's a bakery that says, "Hitler, go to hell. This was our symbol long before the Nazis arose." And they proudly emblazoned. But this, you know, you never do that anymore. But the point is, religion can be toxic. The fact that it's religion. Well, it's religion. Okay, but let's hear about what that religion is. Religion can be dark and shadowy. There are forms of religion within the Inquisition, as far as I'm concerned, was deeply toxic. It was religious. Oh yes, I'm sure. Torquemada was believed to have said, "I'm certain that when I go to heaven, I will see souls coming up, the people that I burned alive, right? And they'll come up with tears of gratitude, thanking me. I would be in hell right now if you hadn't done that to me. Thank you, sir." Japanese fascism, right? Japanese fascism took an elegant Buddhism, crossed it with the cultural predilection towards Bushido, towards samurai culture, and out of that came some horrific stuff. You may have heard of the Thuggee movement, where we get the word thug from. The Thuggees was a devotional cult to the goddess Kali, but it turned on human sacrifice, right? So literally we sacrifice people to Kali because she is the goddess of life and death. So actually there's some good stuff on now. Reza Aslan is doing a series on CNN on the different world religions, and I was astonished that he included the Agori, sort of a dark side of worshiping Shiva, the Lord of the Dance and all that stuff. Also, religion can have extremely dark sides of it. That's why I don't agree with people who say, "Don't call it Islamic terrorism." Actually, folks, it really is Islamic, and it is terrorism, and it's as old as Islam itself. It's a civil war between Shia and Sunni. And if you want to know who the primary victims of ISIS are, it's not Jews, it's not Americans, no, Shiites, right? Shiites. They're seen as heretics and worse, they're seen as being apostates. And the penalty for apostasy is death. Yeah, that's why when it came out that President Obama was a Muslim in his younger life, right? And he said, "Yeah, I did that, but you're telling the world of kind of crazy people out there that you're an apostate," and they get special points for offing you. Other questions, please.
I have a comment. I just wanted to let people know that UUCB has a moon circle that meets tonight at 7 o'clock in this room, and tonight it will be the Norse goddess Idun, who is the goddess of spring and youth and vitality.
The Norse goddess who?
Idun. Yeah, I-D-U-N. Yeah. Yeah, you can come at 7 o'clock. I'm leading it.
That's great. So you're leading a
Mike.
Is it connected to the lunar cycle at all?
Oh, sorry. Is it connected? How hard is it? Here, take this back. Sorry.
It's taken.
I have a PhD. I can do this. Is it connected with the is it?
It's the spring equinox. Yeah, it's a pagan ritual.
Yeah, and that's many pagan religions are indexed to the spring index, to the seasons and the equinox. There's a reason why we celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas. It's at the winter solstice. Yeah, it was an old pagan holiday, and so was the Christmas tree, a pagan celebration. So a lot of the stuff that comes down to us, Easter is another one that comes down to us as the pagan. But did everybody hear the fact that there's going to be at 7 o'clock tonight a celebration? That's great. That's great. That's terrific. I wish I could make it, and I can't. I'm nervously looking at the clock. I used to push it, and everybody had to get into church.
Actually, we have until 10:45 if you want to talk a little bit more.
10:25, did you say?
10:45.
That's 5 minutes left.
Okay. I could just say a word and I'll fly off the handle here. Please, thank you.
So it's the idea that aren't we really, when we're talking about spirituality, talking about the management of energy, that, the idea that karma is this sort of connectedness that we have. The physics principle is quantum entanglement.
Yes.
And so my question is, when we worship, aren't we just sort of finding the same, 40 hertz gamma wavelength when we commune? And
yes,
that music and that prayer and meditation sort of bind us?
In other words, you're sensing a convergence between modern science and a sense of the sacred. Let's not call it religion, because you'll get...
Yes.
Richard Dawkins running out of the room. I think it is, and I'm going to be talking not in exactly in that context now, but our awareness of global warming. It's a sort of a thing. Wait a second. We are part of an ecosystem here that is a delicate balance, but it's actually, I shouldn't say delicate. Lynn Margulis, who worked with, she's a evolutionary scientist, she worked with Lovelock, and one of her essay titles was Gaia is One Tough Bitch. And she obviously is, because we've been working on it, and she has, Gaia, speaking metaphorically now, Gaia has endured horrific insults. The meteor that came down 66 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs, and by the way, wiped out any animal bigger than a cat. That's what many people are saying. And it gave a very unpromising sort of, they look like muskrats to me, but they were kind of early primates, and that's what made room for mammals to arise, and it really set the stage. This conversation would be happening here. I'm not the only one who thinks this, but it would be happening with people who had scales and were intelligent reptiles. Descendants, Saronothoides is what Carl Sagan thought would have taken over. I vote for the Utah raptor. If you saw Jurassic Park, they were called velociraptors. The velociraptors were actually the little green ones that ate the bad guy, remember? And the velociraptors were the 6 feet tall critters, and they were they vocalized, and they were binocular, and they were herd hunting animals. That's the sort of thing out of which, I don't know why they changed it in the movie. Maybe they thought if we called them Utah raptors, it would offend all the Mormons or something like that. Oh, there they go again. They're picking on us again. Who knows? But yes, I think that intelligence, and that's one of the great things that Richard Dawkins said, talks about natural selection. Well, it's just random. It couldn't go. No, it isn't random. It is cumulative. Useful adaptations are saved up. Adaptations that are not useful are very quickly rejected. It has a direction. And his very controversial statement is, once natural selection gets properly started, the emergence of intelligence is all but inevitable. So I tend to agree with that. Why? Not because I'm a teacher or something like that and valorize intelligence. It is clearly the most adaptive, the strongest, the most important trait that we have. It's why we treat lions and tigers and bears as a precious resource. Oh my God, we've got to save them and help them and keep them and cherish them in cages and stuff like that. For most of our species existence, you know, we're going to kill off all the lions. Good. You know, that there's goddamn wolves or bears ate my baby, so I'm ready for them to be wiped out. We now see that we have, because of our intelligence, we recognize the importance of predators to this food chain, and also just for the sheer sense of wonder and majesty, etc. I don't know if I'm making sense. Yeah.
Yes. Energy, the spiritual energy,
yes.
That interconnected
web of life. Yes. And it seems to me that, you know, we can
reconcile a lot of religious worship
with
this, you know, physics.
Yeah, yeah. What evolutionary scientists, which is something that I've been focusing on the last couple of decades, actually. My background is philosophy and religion, but that plugs into this very well. Religion evolved, literally, according to many people, as an adaptation, as a defense adaptation. Those groups that had some sense of a spiritual reality of ancestors who were watching them and judging them, they outperformed other groups. They had a better sense of group cohesion. They were able to suppress what's called freeloading, people who didn't really carry their weight, because maybe you got away with it with all of us, but your ancestors are watching and they're going to come and get you, or the gods are watching. There are people that see everything, and this conferred a survival advantage to groups, and that's why religion in general seems to be so ubiquitous among human cultures. Wherever you find humans, you find some form of religion. It's literally woven into our genes, is the idea. But again, the fact that it's religion does not make it good. There's some dreadful forms of religion, thank you, emerged.
Okay. In ways of thinking, ways of dealing with life, I think, you know, you sort of need both. And the distinction between the two things are the distinction between a craftsman and an artist. A craftsman knows what this product will look like when it's finished, and an artist doesn't.
Interesting. And the question was what? It's very hard to have that in religion because people are investing their hopes. We are a fairly fragile bunch of critters. We have increased our lifespan incredibly. People like Sophocles lived to be 80 years old, but that was almost unheard of. Most people died very young. Death was very real, and we wanted some kind of assurance. And it's not the most noble roots of religion, but it's an explicable one. We need to know what happens to us after we die. I'm particularly attracted to the neo-pagan view, which just says we become what we always were all along. We are a manifestation. We are like a leaf on a tree. That's literally what we are. What happens when we die? Well, we just get recycled. Folks, it's been really nice talking to you this morning. I'm sort of disoriented on the time because I remember people would come running and say, okay, we've got to all go to church now. But that's not apparently quite so much of an emergency. I'll see you next Sunday, I hope.
Thank you. Thank you.